This is Charlottesville Tomorrow. Charlottesville Tomorrow is a nonprofit organization engaging the public on critical quality of life issues so we make informed choices for our community's future. Visit us on the web at seavilletomorrow.org.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. If we can have your attention, please, as we're about to get started with tonight's events.
On September 14th, 2017, the first of several candidate forums for the Charlottesville City Council election was held in City Council chambers by the Virginia Organizing Project. Six candidates are seeking two open seats on the five-member council. The moderator is Jay James.
First, on behalf of Virginia Organizing and all six of the individuals we have with us tonight, just want to thank you for coming out and participating civically as citizens. It's wonderful to see all of you. Just want to thank you for coming out. Wish you a good evening. My name is Jay James. I represent the Bridge Ministry Substance Abuse Program as well as WINA and CBS 19 Television as well. And we have a wonderful event, I think, tonight to hear from these individuals who are running for City Council. And it's sponsored by Virginia Organizing. It's a nonpartisan statewide grassroots organization that works on a variety of issues. Virginia Organizing's goal is to enhance civic participation throughout the Commonwealth. You all are participating tonight. We appreciate that. Tonight, we will have an opportunity to hear from six candidates for the position of City Council here in the city of Charlottesville. It'll go from your left to right. And they are John Edward Hall, Heather Hill, Kenneth Jackson, Amy Laufer, Paul Long, and Nakia Walker. Those are our six candidates. Would you please welcome all six of them tonight? You know, as we begin, I want to commend all six of them because being a civic servant is not an easy job by any stretch of the imagination, and I commend them for wanting to serve their city and for putting themselves out there and devoting the energy that they have to their respective campaigns. So we want to express our appreciation to all six of them for being here tonight and desiring to serve our city in this way. There are two seats, as we said, up for City Council election on Election Day, Tuesday, November 7th. We want to remind you that the deadline to register to vote or update an existing registration is Monday, October 16th, 2017. All right, so just over a month, about 32 days. Also, we want to let you know that tonight's forum will be televised on local Channel 10. It will be rebroadcast at other times before Election Day and will also be on the City of Charlottesville's website as well. We'll introduce the candidates shortly, and they will be given time to present their opening statements. But first, we want to go over the process that we're going to use for this candidates' forum tonight, if we can. Each candidate will be allotted 2 minutes to make an opening statement. We will go in alphabetical order to begin. Lisa King will be our official timekeeper. Lisa, you know, all right. Yellow card will indicate that they have 30 seconds left to speak. A red card will mean that it is time for them to wrap up their comments. Then for every question that we ask them tonight, each candidate will get 2 minutes to answer the question. And rotating who is the first candidate to answer each question. So it won't always be the same order, so we'll try to, you know, equity is always important in these events. So we want to have different people start, but everybody will be allotted 2 minutes to answer the questions. At the end, each candidate will get 2 minutes to make a closing statement in reverse order of the opening statements. And before the forum, we provided the public with an opportunity to submit questions, but we also want the audience to have a chance to offer questions tonight as well, so you can write them down on the card that you were given by our staff on the way in. Please write down your question and hold it up so Harold Foley or Joe Sakas can collect them, and they will pass them up here to me. Yes, Wade Harold and Joe is in the back as well. We'll try to avoid duplicate questions, and we will try to ask the greatest range of questions possible in the time that we have here this evening. Again, we want to thank you for being here tonight. So without further ado, let's begin. And Mr. Hall, you will have 2 minutes to make an opening statement, sir.
Good evening, voters. My name is John Edward Hall. You can look me up on my Facebook account. I am an independent candidate for Charlottesville City Council. Vote this November 7th. These are my core values. I really do care about people in Charlottesville. I am passionate about running for office, making it fun, and I expect to be successful. I expect to speak up and have a say in council business. I like to take ownership and add value where I can to Charlottesville. I respect my fellow man and woman. I am a senior citizen. Knowing these above things about me, I humbly ask for your vote for me this November 7th. Now, I realize I have about a minute extra. I hope that might be afforded to me in my closing statement. Just a general request. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Hall. Ms. Hill?
Good evening, and thank you to Virginia Organizing and their team for putting together tonight's forum, and to all of you for being here, engaged in the civic process. No conversation can happen this evening without recognizing the acts that have taken place in our city of terror in recent months. Our community is hurting, and all of us are seeking answers. Transparency and accountability in how our city is managed has always been a top priority of mine and could not be more important now. A lot of people, including me, are disappointed in the way that leadership has handled the preparation, the execution, and the follow-up to these events. More than ever, our city needs strong leaders who are committed to taking responsibility, finding the answers we desperately seek, and working with our community to solve the city's most complex issues. I am that kind of leader. In February, when I launched my campaign, I committed to listening. Since that time, I have walked every street in our city. Every door knocked by my campaign up to the primary was done by me, to hear firsthand the concerns and priorities among those I hope to serve. What no one should forget is it's what the people of this community think that matters, not the individual leaders. The hours I have spent personally sitting in living rooms and on porches, listening to personal stories, and taking notes has inspired and energized me in ways I couldn't have imagined. The number one priority I heard citywide was affordable housing and enabling people to live and remain in the communities that they call home. Schools and education is another common theme, as our youth are our community's future. How the city allocates its resources has been raised again and again, as we view our resources being wasted on initiatives that result in little to no action. To address the top priorities is going to require leadership with empathy that will listen to all voices. It's going to take partnerships among citizens and leaders. It's going to take an action-oriented problem-solving approach. I look forward to hearing the priorities that are raised in this room this evening and ideas among my fellow candidates for how they may be addressed. Our city's challenges require collaboration.
Thank you, Ms. Hill. Mr. Jackson.
My name is Kenneth. Most people call me Kenny Jackson. I'm 50 years old, born and raised here in Charlottesville. I have a 29-year-old daughter. I was born and raised here in Charlottesville, educated here in Charlottesville. I'm running as an independent for one simple reason. I've been a two-term vice chair of the Democratic Committee, one of the committees in the 5th District. I've also been a Republican candidate. I don't want to be about party. I want to be about people. This city is hurting, and I know. My family was born and raised here. Both of my great-grandfathers were slaves here. So when people start knocking Charlottesville, we were a beautiful city. We got along. We learned how to talk to each other and respect each other. There are certain issues that face this city that will not go away. Some of them is how do we rebuild after the 12th? We're going to do that with strong leadership and cooperation. We're going to learn how to respect each other and how to talk to one another. We've got to do that. If we don't do that, then we're going to always be fighting each other. As far as apparent, you know, what I am, I'm liberal in the fact that I respect everyone's rights, and everyone has a right to live. I'm conservative in the fact that I respect the value of a dollar. I'm doing the math up here, and we're sitting in $3,600 worth of chairs. That's 3 months' rent for some people. I believe in open government. When I say open, I mean open. I don't like secret meetings unless they have to be. And those only have to be personnel or business is going to be affected by opening it to the public. Other than that, we sit here in front of the community and we do your job. When you call us, we answer. That's the way I was raised. That's the way the city came about being. And that's the way we stayed a community. And we love each other.
Thank you, Mr. Jackson. Ms. Laufer.
Hi. I want to also say thank you to Virginia Organizing for hosting this event. I've known Jose Coates and Harold Foley for many years, and I really appreciate this opportunity to have a community dialogue about where our city is going. You know, many of you have known I've been in the school board for the past 6 years in community service, and the tragic events this summer, you know, which I witnessed firsthand and many of you witnessed firsthand, are completely traumatizing. And for us, you know, those scenes were terror that was played out in familiar places, places that we go almost every day. And for those familiar places to become places of scenes of terror, death, tanks, it's extremely terrifying and traumatic for our community. And on top of all that, we don't feel like we've heard much information from our community leaders, either leading up to it, the day of, or even now. And this only adds to the trauma that we're all feeling. And it really reminds me how important leadership is. And it only makes me feel like I want to be more purposeful and more serious about the hard work that faces us. You know, these groups left are that invaded us, they've left, but we are still here together to deal with the decades of abuse and neglect to our minority communities, to welcome our refugee community, and to support our Jewish neighbors. And I want to be able to help deal with these issues as a city council member. And I really look forward to talking with all of you tonight and in the future on how to move Charlottesville forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Laufer. Mr. Long?
I want to thank the Virginia Organizing for hosting this forum tonight. And I've been a resident of Charlottesville for 20 years. I'm originally from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. I think the events that we saw in the last 4 months, the American Constitution, the preamble, lists ensuring domestic tranquility as one of the reasons why we set up the national government, and that means protecting citizens. And our government completely broke down in the last 4 or 5 months and did not provide protection for the citizens. Somebody gave the police department an order to stand down while citizens were beat up and assaulted and killed. And there's a lot of videos that prove that fact. Somebody should be made to answer for that. I think the entire 5 members of City Council said that they were sorry, and they are a very sorry group of leaders. I think all of them should resign. I do think we need a new, entirely new board. And I've been spending the last 3 days trying to find out how I can circulate a petition to have Mayor Cigna removed. I'll eventually find out how to go about doing that. But I think he's very arrogant. But I just want to give a little bit of information about myself. When I was in the Philadelphia area, I lived in a community right next to Philadelphia called Tenicum Township. For those who may be familiar with Philadelphia, half of Philadelphia International Airport is in that township. 36 years ago, I led an effort to have public transportation continue in that community. I was a member of the Board of Health. In Pennsylvania, we're a little bit different. We usually change parties every 4 to 6 years. I'm used to dealing with Democrats and Republicans. You know, I'm also active in the Charlottesville Coalition for the Homeless. The way we treat our homeless people in this city is a disgrace. And even though good things are happening, a lot more needs to be done. We need to establish a 12-month emergency shelter for anybody who's living in the streets, and I'll stop there.
Thank you, Mr. Long. Ms. Walker?
Good evening. I'm Nakia Walker. I'm an independent for Charlottesville City Council. I chose to run as an independent to kind of force, not to kind of, but to force conversations that I thought and know that we needed to have way before the events of July 8th, August 11th, and August 12th occurred. My campaign slogan, Unmasking the Illusion, back in March when I launched, people thought I was being a little dramatic. They wanted to know what illusion I was alluding to. What was I talking about? I constantly heard you're being dramatic. But that's the way what you see in videos, what you see in pictures, you know, those pictures are telling stories on their own without people opening their mouths. That's the life that a lot of people, especially black, brown, and white poor people in Charlottesville have lived. So this Charlottesville that I keep hearing we are attempting to get back to, it has never existed for a majority of the population. And that was why I chose to run, to call attention to the issues and the suffering of a lot of the Charlottesville families. I'm a native. I've raised three children in Charlottesville. Most of my family is here. And I have been committed, even before it was, okay to challenge, okay to talk about Black Lives Matter, before anyone was comfortable with these challenging conversations we are having as a result of the summer. I've spent, especially the time between 2004 and now, having those challenging conversations in any room that I have been in, and will continue. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Walker. All right, ladies and gentlemen, it's time for our first question. Each of you will have 2 minutes to answer the following question. And Ms. Hill, you will go first. Question number one is, do you believe all employers should pay a living wage? Why or why not?
I do believe that people who work here should be able to afford to live here. It's difficult for me when I look at the teachers that my children go to school with, to the first responders that are, you know, supporting our community, that when I ask them where they live, many of them cannot afford to live in the city, and they don't, and that disconnect hurts all of us. I do support working to achieve a living wage. I feel it must be done in a way that is thoughtful, however, and does not ultimately hurt workers through reduced hours or eliminating jobs. I really want to work with stakeholders both in the public and private sector to uncover what are the barriers for us to try to achieve that in both public and private sector. Because I will say I certainly have talked to a lot of small business owners, and there are barriers that will allow them to keep their businesses within our city if we are forcing upon them, you know, a wage and some of the numbers that have been thrown out, as much as $17.50 an hour for everyone across the board. At the same time, there are other ways I think we could be supporting these communities beyond just the wage itself, and that comes through the programming that we offer. Obviously, childcare and transportation are major hurdles for so many families in our community, and I feel that the more we can do to support those types of things, that can reduce costs. But we also need to be working most hard on workforce development so that we can help those people that are in the greatest need to get the skills they need to earn the wages that are going to allow them to have a fulfilling life here in the community. I really certainly am committed to working again with public and private stakeholders to determine how we can get to that living wage, and understanding it, what balances we have to face within our city's budget and obviously within those businesses' budgets, and what are the barriers. But I certainly am committed that people who live here should be able to afford to live here and not just be putting food on the table, but have a thriving life.
Thank you very much, Ms. Hill. Mr. Jackson.
Well, this concerns me a lot because my daughter lives down on 15 in Buckingham. Why? Because she can't afford to live in the city she was born and raised in, went to school in, worked in. We have a lot of issues facing us when it comes to living wage, especially the way we present it. I personally could not sit here and take a pen and swipe it and say $17.50, especially when our city, 20% of our city employees don't make a living wage. So if we want everyone else to get with the program, we've got to get on board. One of those ways of bringing back jobs and increasing job training is to start hiring people in our city. Start hiring contractors and stuff within our area so our workforce can grow. We had a Wheels to Work program at one time. I don't know why that was disbanded. We need to look at our bus routes. There are some people who work and don't get off until 2 in the morning, but the buses don't run. They're in the bar industry, the restaurant industry, the nursing industry. So
if we're going to get serious about it, we're going to have to look at every aspect. Everyone's not going to college. We've got to face that fact. I went to technical school, proud of it, earned $46,000 before I had to go on disability. So that was interesting. But we have several ways that we have to approach this. It's going to start with education. We have to have an educated workforce, but it's also going to start with bringing real jobs into this area. That way we can boost the hourly wage.
Thank you, Mr. Jackson. Ms. Loeffler?
Certainly, on the school board, we faced this question several years ago, and we did a phased approach where we each year took another group of our employees and pushed them to a living wage with substitutes, our assistant, instructional assistants, our cafeteria workers, and this year was our bus drivers. And we also realized that offering health care was something that was really important to all of these people, because a lot of times they were just making enough to pay for the health insurance. So I think it's a multitude issue, and I think we have to face it at many different levels. Of course, what we talked about, transportation, daycare, these all drive the cost of living up. And, you know, if you work full-time, you should be able to afford to feed your family. I think we can all agree on that. And I would definitely be committed to working with private industry to make this a reality. But I also, something I ran on and I feel very passionate about, is workforce development. I call it the Piedmont Promise, where we can support our own individual students going to PVCC to get their degree. I've already met with Dr. Friedman maybe four times already to talk about this. We have some proposals of how much it might cost, and it's well within the city's budget right now. And, you know, I just feel very passionate that workforce development is the key to helping people realize a more successful living wage or even beyond. So I'd be excited to work on that. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Loeffler. Again, the question, if you're just joining us, is do you believe all employers should pay a living wage? Why or why not? Mr. Long?
Henry Ford, who was had many faults, and when he was running Ford Motor Company back in 1904, did a very remarkable act that brought down the wrath of fellow industrialists. He raised his employees' pay to the grand sum of $2 an hour, which back in 1904 was a great deal of money. And when his fellow industrialists were saying, why are you doing this? He says, how can I expect my workers to buy cars if I'm not giving them a living wage? You know, the reason I point that out is that if you give people a living wage, that's going to bring up more disposable income for people to spend, and it's going to help increase the economy. I believe Charlottesville should diversify the kind of work that we have. I think if young people are industrious enough to go to college to become lawyers or designers or architects, we don't have those kinds of jobs in the city. And if they have the initiative to seek higher education, we should be in a position that those kinds of jobs exist in the city. I don't think it's ridiculous to ask McDonald's and Hardee's and fast food restaurants to pay their workers $17.50. When they give their annual reports, they're making a lot of profit, and a great part of that profit should be going into paying their workers. I've been advocating for the last 8 years the creation of a regional transit authority comprising the city of Charlottesville, Albemarle County, and the surrounding counties. I believe our buses should be running every 20 minutes. I believe we should have bus routes into the extended counties, because a lot of people cannot afford cars. And even those who do have a car, if you look at the traffic congestion in this city, we need to get a percentage of drivers off the street, because we can't afford to continue to expand building new highways and new roads. We have to have a percentage of our people, convince them to use public transportation. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Mr. Long. Ms. Walker?
Yes, I believe that the city of Charlottesville should pay a living wage. I've been advocating for the past year and a half for the city itself to pay a living wage. Back in January 2016, the city was still paying $10.95 to its employees, entry-level employees. and having discussions with UVA at the same time about the fact that they needed to pay a living wage when they weren't paying it themselves. We do not have discussions about pay if you look at the salaries of the at the administrative level. We don't have discussions about whether they should be able to afford to live here, whether they should make a salary that is comparable to other to other people in their field. They pay themselves very well. You have close to $100,000 and over, the city manager over $200,000 when you look at the benefit package attached to it. And yet when they sit around the table, and you have to sit in on these budget meetings to see how the conversation goes around who should make what. And so when you're talking about $10.95 an hour, and you are having conversations with the University of Virginia, the largest employer, about the fact that they should pay a living wage and you don't, and it's okay with you. So in that time frame, since I started that discussion, the city moved to $11.17 an hour, and this past July they moved to $13.79 per hour. And if you make the decision, set it as a priority, you can make it work. If you look at revenues of the corporations in the area, there's a lot of money flowing through the city. So you just have to value people over capitalism, and then once you do that, you can make it work.
All right. Thank you very much, Ms. Walker. All right. We'll conclude this question. Mr. Hall.
I support a living wage of $12 per hour because employers need a break too, and employees who work hard should be rewarded with raises above my concept of a living wage. Take time to know the employees' needs and capabilities that are richly rewarded by raises. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Hall. It's on to our next question. We're going to be starting with you, Mr. Jackson. The question reads as follows. Charlottesville needs more affordable housing. What are two specific proposals that you think the city council should pursue to deal with this issue? Each of you will have 2 minutes to respond.
One of the problems with affordable housing in the city of Charlottesville is really we've sat there and we've made laws and regulations that make it impossible. You used to be able to build modular homes here. It's a modular home you can build and sell for about $150,000. That's in an affordable income bracket for people who are like friends that I know who've worked for 25 to 35 years. But they can't afford to build a home because they can't afford a $300,000-some home. Affordable housing comes in several parts. One is public housing. You know, public housing is dilapidated. We've allowed for four decades our public housing to run down, even though there's been money given religiously by the federal government for the upkeep of these units and the renovation of these units. So when you talk about affordable housing, there's a couple of concepts to it. It's also like people will lump elderly and disabled in the same thing as low income. Low income means you can work. That means we've got to help you work, help you improve yourself, help you clear your credit and stuff so we can open affordable housing. But we have to make regulations and stuff a little less than what they are now. The fact of the matter is, if you can't build a McMansion in Charlottesville, Charlottesville doesn't want you. It's a bad feeling when you feel that you want me to come and work in this city, but when it's time for anything else, I got to go home. I mean, I looked at the development plan for West Main Street. I feel real bad because there's only two black people in it. And most everyone looks rich. Are you building the city for everyone or just the filthy rich and elite?
Thank you, Mr. Jackson. Ms. Laufer?
You know, I think a lot of our issues, especially with traffic and a lot of other things, is because there's not affordable housing. When I met with the Habitat for Humanity, some of their studies say that we have a 4,000 home deficit that is including Albemarle County. But when you think about that, that is like almost insurmountable when you think of how we've doubled the fund to $3.2 million. The city council has doubled that. But that comes out to like $400 a home. You know, so the fund is a great asset to have. I think we really have to be more mindful of how we use it. And I really believe that if somebody's going to come and ask for a special use permit, they have to provide the affordable units in the place that they're building it. And I also think we have to stop taking money in lieu of actual homes. You know, and I think the reason this happens a lot is because our policy is not tight enough. So, you know, I'd be willing to go in there and really figure out, like, what does it mean? What is the square footage? What is the AMI, the annual mean income? You know, what are the things that we are trying to get at and make it possible so they can actually be built? And I also think we can be more creative in helping these people build them. There's something called VHDA. It's the Virginia Housing Development Authority. They actually give loans to people that are going to build homes that are affordable. That's their whole mission. And we need to work with them and our private industry to create that, you know, make this more possible. Because we're just going to continue, you know, we would feel totally different about those buildings on West Main if they actually had affordable units. How much better we would feel if we knew nurses were there, residents were there, doctors were there, because they could walk in and right to their work and to home. You know, those would not be as upsetting to us if we actually had people living there that actually work here. So thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Laufer. Mr. Long.
Right after World War II, the federal government set up the Federal Housing Authority and guaranteed mortgages to millions of veterans coming home from that war, which caused a housing boom throughout the country. Unfortunately, most of it was in the suburbs, but it provided new housing to millions of people after the United States was just coming out of the Depression. I don't believe that government is the enemy, and I believe that there is a strong area where government, and I'm talking about what national government, the state government, and the local government, to actively pursue the building of low-cost housing for its citizens. And you mentioned the Virginia
HCA.
That could be one agency. We have to work with Richmond. I don't see much happening with Mr. Trump being in the White House and the Republicans controlling Congress, but that's not going to last forever. The Democrats will come back to power, and we have to start using creative means to get billions of dollars in Washington and Richmond to build affordable housing, whether it's the government doing it or whether it's private industry doing it. There is an awful lot of open land in Charlottesville. I was walking about the area, the strategic development area, and I don't think any of that land should be used for high-priced, you know, housing. That's open land that should be reserved for low-income people and houses to be built. And if the private industry won't do it, we should enter into negotiations for the city to have the city do it in the state.
Thank you, Mr. Long. Before we continue with this question, each of the candidates receiving 2 minutes. Just to remind you of the question, we're talking about affordable housing. We're looking for two specific proposals that you think the city council should pursue to deal with the issue. We now turn to Ms. Walker.
So I think first we need to make sure that we understand that there are families in Charlottesville who are not, first responders, teachers, doctors, nurses. We have families who are, their annual income is $10,000 or less. So when you talk about first, we need to make sure that affordable housing in terms of public housing is expanded. Tax credit properties, those units, we know we have an 8,000 unit deficit, and the commitment to rebuild that means that city council would have to, one, make it a priority and make sure they are focused on the outcomes for individuals who cannot afford to build, get loans, who don't have access to the credit for those kind of programs. The first, we are seeing that in the SIA development with Friendship Court. You have the ratios there, the last that I was in those meetings, where they want to take the 150 units that are currently on that prime real estate property and turn it into a 600 unit, where the majority of those units are market rate, 350 of them or more the last time that I was aware, to make sure that people who can afford market rate wanted to live there. So that is called white tolerance, you know. And so you have 150, the same number of units there now, 48 to 50 units for workforce housing, and then the rest market rate. So it's clear, even when you're talking about land that's now for public housing, the intention to transform that when it's already owned by the people who live there, it's their right to remain there, to transform that into a market rate property. So we have to make sure that we stop developments like that.
Thank you, Ms. Walker. We now turn our attention to Mr. Hall.
Okay, two proposals for affordable housing. One, Conestoga Coroplast wagons, mobile homes that can be made for about $150 each to tide a person who is homeless over until more adequate solutions can be found. I work with three UVA nurses, and Becky Blanton and David Duravi, who we completed this past one of these mobile homes this past Tuesday. Two, I agree with Ms. Laufer that Habitat for Humanity does an excellent job of building for those in need. It is a program where the owner participates in building the house to promote pride and ownership, which I think is very important. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hall. Ms. Hill?
As I mentioned, the time that I spent in the community, the number one thing I heard was the affordability of housing in our community. And just last weekend over on 6th Street, revisiting some folks I met in the spring, I had a conversation with a woman who is a widower and retired and saw that she could enjoy her time in her home in her retirement years. But 2 years ago, her extended family was put out of the property they were previously renting because that owner wanted to sell it. And now she has six people living with her in her small home for 2 years because there really isn't an option for them to go elsewhere. That's not acceptable. We need a commitment on council, and quite frankly, I don't see a broad commitment on council right now. And I think that, obviously, hearing the voices up here, I'm confident that we're going to have that commitment in the time moving forward. But our city really needs to work with partnerships, both with the housing authority and the private sector and other investors, to leverage the funds we have. Because when you just allocate a larger chunk of funds for just a few units, you're wasting those resources, because those can be used as a stepping stone to really entice those developers to come in. Because at the end of the day, it is going to have to be about money for some of those developers. But we need to be able to kind of have that carrot and leverage those funds in a way that kind of invites them in. And another way to do that is through land and purchasing of land. I know there's a property right now on the MACA property that everyone seems to have trouble developing on and finding something that's going to work for the surrounding area. But I really think that that's a prime opportunity for multiple acres of land that we really could be tapping into to really put some affordable housing just north of our downtown area, because I think it does need to come and happen throughout the city and not just in the urban center. We really also need to look at other local jurisdictions. When they were talking about the zoning earlier, we know that there are jurisdictions in Northern Virginia and also in Virginia Beach that have included affordable housing requirements in their zoning. So the answer that really isn't possible, I really would like to press forward on and feel like we should be really looking outside of the box and understanding how other places, this is not new to us and not new to Charlottesville, but how can we leverage what has been learned by others and apply it here in Charlottesville to achieve this goal.
Thank you very much, Ms. Hill. Our next question will begin with you, Ms. Laufer. What are your goals and plans to deal with structural racism in Charlottesville?
Well, certainly structural racism is not okay. You know, I grew up actually in rural poverty in Wisconsin, and yet it's really from that experience it was difficult for me to see that I had privilege. You know, I shared a bed with my sister until somebody left the house, and I basically hoped my sister would not wear that sweater because then I couldn't wear it. You know, but I've really come to realize, you know, I've had privilege because just by the virtue of my skin, I've been given the benefit of the doubt, you know. And this really opened my eyes to this fact a couple years ago when I was with a colleague of mine, and we were on a conference, and my colleague was African American, and we were both checking in to the same hotel. And they asked my colleague for a $100 deposit on her credit, their credit card, and not me. The indignity of that for my colleague broke my heart. You know, broke my heart. We are colleagues, we are equals, and I can't tell you how outraged I was. You know, this is a problem, it exists, it's bigger than any one of us, and, you know, not one person can fix it. It's really within each of us to understand and understand ourselves and be respectful of other people and have an open mind when we meet people and understand what we're bringing to the table. And I'm really pledging that, yeah, I may not be able to fix this on my own. It's going to take a lot of people, but I'm willing to talk about it and deal with it.
Thank you very much, Ms. Loeffler. Mr. Long.
I was talking to my friend John Hall, who's sitting all the way at the end there, and I'm 2 years older than he is. And next week, I'll be 68, so because Bob Fenwick lost the primary, I'm the oldest candidate running for city council. I came of age in the 1960s. I graduated from high school in 1967, the so-called Summer of Love. And as a child growing up, my father was born and raised in New York City. My mother was from the South, born and raised in Lafayette, Louisiana. At the age of 7 and 8, 9, 10, and 12, I used to watch my parents watch the news when there was the riots in Little Rock, Arkansas, with Governor Faubus refusing to desegregate that high school, and then having the Air Force, African-American Air Force veteran, having federal marshals with rifles, making the governor of Mississippi back down so he could be admitted. The 60s were very ugly, and the struggle that we were going through, there is structural racism. I believe we need federal leadership, and we're not going to get that with President Trump. But a lot of the grosser things that happened in the 60s was put an end to by President Lyndon Baines Johnson when he told Governor Wallace and other southern governors, you're not going to put hoses and blow out, and allow churches to be blown up because I'm sending the troops and federal marshals down to put an end to it. That's what I call it, forceful leadership. We need that kind of leadership in Washington. We need that kind of leadership in Richmond, and we need that kind of leadership in Charlottesville as well. It's not going to be solved overnight, you know, and I'm just going to say this briefly. The hatred that I saw exhibited in the 1960s with a lot of white people towards African Americans, a lot of that hasn't gone away. What Lyndon Johnson did was something you're not going to go around killing people and beating people up, but that hatred with a lot of people still exists. And we have to figure a way out with forceful leadership to try to change that and to, you know, guarantee that everybody is going to be able to live in a fairly in the United States. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Long. Ms. Walker.
Can you repeat?
Absolutely. So the question is, we're looking for each of the candidates' goals and plans to deal with structural racism in Charlottesville.
Okay. So just by racism is a white creation, and so what it requires to dismantle it is that white people start thinking differently about how they move through the world, and that takes a lot of introspection, which people are not used to doing. And you have to be willing to be challenged at every level and deal with that. So, again, we're talking about a city that was founded on the backs of other people. And we have lived this very dual existence, this two cities, this beautiful ugly, since the creation of the city. And so for me, what I have done that wasn't appreciated was to sit in rooms and challenge people to look at policies that they were coming up with, how did they know what they thought they knew, and were they willing to look at what they were sure were the right things you know, honor the people who actually have the answers to those questions. And so I'm hearing very different conversations since the summer has happened, but we know how quickly we attempt to forget when we are being taught lessons. So it's really up to you all to decide what kind of city we want to live in, and are you going to challenge yourselves individually to unlearn some of the things that you have learned to dismantle, because that's an individual, and then it becomes a collective. It's not something I can only offer to continue to challenge when I'm in the room.
Thank you, Ms. Walker. Now to you, Mr. Hall.
Yes, the question was racism structural in Charlottesville, my goals and plans. I think about the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., who said we should not judge a person by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. I believe in what Martin Luther King Jr. said. My goals and plans, listen and enact change to promote racial harmony in Charlottesville. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hall. Ms. Hill.
I agree. I have not walked the streets as a minority. I have that privilege, and it's up to me to determine how I'm going to allow myself to look through the lens as if I was a minority for every decision I make if I have the opportunity to sit on this dais. It does start with individuals kind of making that personal commitment and challenging each other. We all should be daily challenging each other and working with each other to help to raise our children in a way that this isn't even a question for them. But I think that once we can work through those individual things, I think there's so much also to be gained by working together as a community. I just go back to the time that I've spent in every neighborhood of this community has taught me so much. And I came into this race really feeling like there was a lot of, I guess, my professional background or things I had seen as a neighborhood leader that was really kind of driving why I wanted to do this. But it was those connections with individuals throughout this community that elevated me in a new way to want and just to be so passionate about why I want to do this, because I see people who largely want to work together to make this a better place for all of us at every income level, regardless of your race or where you're from or if you're legal or illegal. And so I really feel like there's a lot of benefit for us to work together to invest ourselves and even some resources in more community building at that level. And the more that I've had the opportunity to introduce people in my personal network with those that I've met while I'm out, you can just start to see those connections be made. And I think that, again, it does start with us as individuals, but it's really going to be this community that it's going to allow us to really break down those structural barriers that is in place. And I do feel that it does involve listening, even to those voices that you don't agree with or that are different perspectives than your own. I've learned something from every voice that I've listened to, and I really encourage all of us to take that perspective.
Thank you very much, Ms. Hill. And finally to you, Mr. Jackson.
Two things, time and circumstance. We all yell about the Southern Poverty Law Center. Deeds, who grew up in a Klan family and a racist family, changed over time and circumstance. But I'd like to think that we changed also because we learned how to respect one another and talk with one another. Before we get it all twisted, and it really bothers me when we just want to point fingers at white people, we all have some racism in us. Sit here and tell me you haven't called a white person a cracker, or you haven't called a Mexican a wetback. Let's be real. I mean, if you're going to be real, we're going to be real. Because until we get real, nothing's going to change. Now, the Klan and all them, they came here. Did any of us notice how few of them there were? Don't let the minority become the majority. If we really care and love each other and treat each other as one, and you look at me not as a black man, but as a person, I don't need pity. I don't need white guilt. What I need is for you to look at me as an equal. That's what Martin Luther King wanted. Let's walk hand in hand together. I'm not going to drop a guilt trip on you. Yes, we have issues on all sides. We got issues in our own race. We can sit there and lie about it.
There are blacks who are up here, and the poor ones they look at like we're down here. We've got a lot to fix. And we've got to start inside of ourselves, and we've got to start by sitting down and discussing it, not blaming.
Thank you, Mr. Jackson. Our next question, we'll start with you, Mr. Long. And the question reads as follows. What systems of police accountability should we have in the city of Charlottesville, both through city council and outside of city council?
Philadelphia, my home city, has a police review board made up of civilians that reviews the actions of the Philadelphia Police Department. And they have the power to subpoena witnesses, and the city government has a hands-off policy when they investigate. I think the city of Charlottesville needs a civilian control board to oversee the police department. Somebody on August 12th gave the order for the police to stand down. I don't know who it was. Different names have been suggested. The man who's been appointed to conduct the investigation is a Democratic flunky who just donated money to Democratic candidates, and he's not going to be impartial. But we need to create that. And, you know, we need people to be courageous, to confront the police department when the actions are taken. And that can be a scary thing for a lot of people. But the citizens at large have to realize that, you know, the police department serves us. You know, I respect anybody who becomes a police officer because I wouldn't be able to do it. But and they need the tools to do a good job, but they need to also be overviewed to make sure that they're doing the job properly and that they're treating people with respect and decency. That's it.
Thank you, Mr. Long. Ms. Walker?
Yeah, so for police accountability, the Citizen Review Board is primarily with some enforcement power. That's what we are not seeing. If you have ever filed a complaint with the police department, if you watch them, they are in charge of reviewing that complaint, and they don't even have to give you the information as to the outcome of the complaint. So it's all internal, and you never really know what's going on. So again, there are certain communities in Charlottesville who've been dealing with that forever, and we were able to see on a larger scale during the events of the summer what never getting those answers look like. So again, a citizen review board with some enforcement power would be the starting point for that. And when you're also looking at the chief law enforcement officer of the community, who does the prosecutor's office answer to. And so we need to make sure that across the board that we are holding individuals accountable if their behavior is unethical.
Thank you, Ms. Walker. Mr. Hall.
We have cameras now on cars, and some police wear them on their uniforms. We need more rigorous training in police academies to promote racial harmony and stop racial profiling. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hall. And again, as we are about halfway through this question, it's regard to police accountability and what should the city council role be, and also outside of the city council. And the question is to you, Ms. Hill.
Sure. I mean, I think the city council can obviously set up some of the policies that can be in place that we then ask that our cities, both whatever review board they pull in or as well as our law enforcement, to follow. I think without the proper metrics, you're just never going to have that kind of accountability. I think too often we obviously let some of these things go, and there isn't anyone reviewing from the outside. And when that happens, it's all internal, and obviously there's a lot of error and major issues with that happening. And I understand there's a police advisory panel that is set up, but even they will acknowledge their own ineffectiveness right now. So we have this group of people that are spending time and resources, but they're not really being able to effectively do it because they really can't review the things they need to review. And so I would echo what other people have said, that we really need to look at a community review board I know that other cities are doing that, and I understand that Richmond is considering that right now, and so they're right next to us. That's not too far away. I think that if we can start to leverage relationships with other jurisdictions who have had success and can help to set up those metrics, that's really where the accountability can come in. In any organization, if you aren't able to, you know, give someone a metric by which to be measured, you can't ever look back and hold them accountable and then take the action of seceding them from their job or to giving them those disciplinary actions. And so I think that we really have to have that structure in place. And I also agree. I feel like training is fundamental. I think sometimes there are those biases that we don't even recognize that we have, and I think that we certainly need to support our law enforcement with those supporting features as well. So. But again, I'm just going to echo that the Community Review Board, an independent group of people that can then provide communication back out to the community, will be something that I think the community can trust, because right now there certainly has been a history and it certainly has now been elevated of lack of trust between this community and its law enforcement, and that certainly is not safe for any of us.
Thank you, Ms. Hill. Mr. Jackson.
Yes, my understanding was we had this in place actually years ago. Never really worked. As you said, they don't have enough control and authority. Police accountability, to me, should not be in the hands of the city manager or city council. We do need our own review board. They also have to have access to the personnel records. That's one of the holdbacks to it. They can't get personnel issues, and they can't address these people because they're personnel issues, which, as council, we need to make ordinances and make changes to the code where these people have the right to act. We appoint them. They have the right to act within the best interest of the citizens when it comes to reviewing police. Also, we need to look at profiling. When I say profiling, trust me, I've been arrested here. I mean, the assistant chief, he knows me by my first name. He knew me by my nickname. So I'm going to tell you, when I say profiling, it ain't just racial. I've actually been stopped, and me and my white friends were handcuffed because we didn't look a certain way. We didn't act a certain way. I've known white people who are more bebop and gangster than I am, and make no mistake, they've had cuffs put on. Profiling is a very dangerous thing. Because the ones that you're not suspecting in the three-piece suit is probably the one walking in with the briefcase that's going to blow you up. So profiling doesn't always work. And the one that looks like a thug might just save your life. But we definitely need better oversight, and they need to be able to not just go to the Commonwealth attorney, but if they have to, go to the Attorney General. Because sometimes our Commonwealth attorney doesn't always do right.
Thank you, Mr. Jackson. Ms. Laufer.
Well, I would just echo what everybody said. You know, I come to meetings, and it's brought up several times during city council meetings, and when I was knocking doors, this was a common theme that people feel like they're either being profiled or, you know, if somebody has an altercation with the police, there should be a protocol of following up with these people. You know, one gentleman told me that his son had been shot by the police. And I thought to myself how traumatic that would be. There should be a protocol in place that we circle back to let him know what's happening. I mean, he just felt like there was no communication. And this is something I think we really have to take seriously. And I know the panel, the citizen review panel, is, as they have said, that they don't feel effective themselves. So clearly that's not working. And I'd really be interested in the Citizen Review Board, which has been mentioned multiple times, and we do see that our neighbors are taking this on, and we've seen it at other cities, you know, because we need to have faith in our police, you know, and if we don't, then the system is just breaking down, and I would fully support a Citizen Review Board.
Thank you very much, Ms. Laufer. Again, we're about an hour into our candidate forum that is presented by Virginia Organizing. On behalf of Virginia Organizing, first of all, ladies and gentlemen, you have thus far been a wonderful audience. Thank you for your attentiveness, and thank you for listening to our candidates. And to our candidates, it is not easy when you have a full platform to truncate answers to difficult questions into 2 minutes. And I think it bears mentioning the job that they're doing thus far tonight. So we want to thank them for what they're doing. So, absolutely.
Thanks, Jay.
All right. We commence to hour two, and our next question, we're going to start with you, Ms. Walker. And the question is as follows. Do you think our current methods of citizen participation are effective in the local governing process?
Not at all. We definitely need to expand citizen engagement, and we need to look how to make sure that people who generally are not in meetings, do not know what's going on until it's affecting them, you know, last minute, are engaged in the process. And that primarily takes trust. You have to build those relationships, and you have to make sure that people don't feel like they're wasting their time and energy, and that they understand that you know, they are valued. So that's one thing that I definitely want to focus on. I'm not a big social media person. I had a Facebook before the campaign, but I didn't use it, you know, much. I had 76 people, real friends, you know, on it, and now I have this campaign Facebook where people are talking to me all the time. But that's what we want, right? So I'm learning, but I think the social media, expanding that, Facebook, Twitter, you know, in my mind, I see, like, when we have the screens, that we have something like that flowing where people are able to tweet during council meetings who may not come and show up in a room. So I think we definitely have to expand who we hear. We also have to make sure that we are respectful to people who show up at meetings. You know, the current rules that were put in place, some of them challenged in the court system. We have to make sure that we have an open form of government where citizens across the board understand that their voice is needed and respected, and that we are here to listen to them, not to, you know, figure out ways to not have their input. So it's very important that we expand.
Thank you very much, Ms. Walker. We now turn to you, Mr. Hall. Same question.
This is a tough question, I think. 2 to 3 minutes is often allowed for citizens to speak at meetings. It's usually before the meeting really gets underway by the council people. And I wish there could be more time allotted, but if more time were allotted, you wouldn't have much time to really get the town business taken care of. So, you know, I think it's good later on in the meeting there is a second time for the public to participate and maybe speak a little bit longer. I like that. And it's has to do with preparation. As long as you prepare and have your ducks in a row, usually I think the city council can kind of oblige that and give that more of their attention. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Hall. We now turn to you, Ms. Hill.
So I would say that of the all the people that I did meet throughout the spring, I have a short list of about 40 to 50 that I felt like I made a meaningful connection with, but they also had something special that I feel like they could bring to the table for this community. And many of them I turned to and asked after they shared their experiences with me and their expertise and things I think we really could benefit from their voices. Why didn't they get more involved? I think that the way we have it set up, both in council meetings and through community meetings, it's not appropriate for all people. Not everybody wants to sit at 7 p.m. and listen to a PowerPoint presentation. Not everybody is comfortable in a room such as this and coming and having their voice heard by this type of, you know, this type of setting. But what I'm even more concerned about is that in the last couple of months, people are even less interested in coming into this room specifically. And how do we make this more inviting for people and less intimidating? Because obviously the tenor of our community has changed, but we need to be able to have respectful conversations together so we can hear each other's voices. So I think, obviously, in the world of the city council meetings themselves, I've been a proponent of, can we just take these on the road? Maybe once a quarter we'll go to Johnson Elementary, one week we'll go to Jackson Bay, another quarter, where we can, if there's something on the agenda that involves that community, why aren't we going out to them and inviting them to a different, you know, atmosphere than this atmosphere, something that they're familiar with and maybe more comfortable with. We also, beyond the city council meetings, need to do a better job of leveraging community organizations that reach out to all segments of our population. And they do tremendous groundwork to have access to a wide array of constituencies, and they are effective at engaging those communities. But somehow that bridge is not being connected between those great organizations that are doing that work and connecting and hearing those voices and our city's government. So I'm really a person who wants to kind of start to work to build those bridges so that all of the voices can be heard by our city and that we can all take the action to move forward.
Thank you very much, Ms. Hill. The question that our candidates are, they are evaluating current methods of citizen participation and whether or not they think they're effective in the local governing process. And we turn to you, Mr. Jackson.
Well, this is just from the people I've talked to, which have been all over the city. First of all, they don't want to come here. Not now. There's no way for them to talk and get their point across. Their legitimate concerns, because the finger, putting up your middle finger, yelling at people and stuff. We have to have some dignity and respect for one another. The same respect you want from me, I want from you. Doesn't mean you agree with me. It's called social decency. Social respect is what I teach my child. It's what I teach my grandchildren. You will be treated the way you treat people. And it's a shame when I have citizens, seniors, and everything else saying, I'm not going down there into that mess. So we have to keep a certain decorum and rule of etiquette. The other thing, too, is list your number. The phone number listed is mine. People say, I shouldn't do it. They'll threaten you. I really don't care. Maybe you just want to yell, whine, and moan. At least I can listen. Maybe you have an actual question, and it's a legitimate question, and we can discuss it and stuff. As a counselor, it's my job to remember that, write it down, and bring it back to the next meeting if you can't be here. We also need to realize people need to talk about what they want to talk about up front. Don't make them wait 2-3 hours and drag it out and then think they're going to talk about it at the end of the meeting. That's ridiculous. If you have time to govern, you have time to listen to people. I can go to 12, 1 o'clock. And the other counselors, I don't know. Everybody wanted a raise, but nobody wants to put in time. But to me, you need to be available 24 hours a day. Even if someone just texts you, you can't get back in touch with them, let them know.
Thank you, Mr. Jackson. Ms. Laufer.
Sure. Well, I think increasing civic engagement and citizen participation is critical. Actually, when I was at one of the meetings, somebody said there's 169 boards or commissions that citizens are on for the city. And I thought, good grief. I mean, that is just so incredible, honestly. But I think the truth is that this is a very uncomfortable space, right? Yeah, those seats feel like they're made maybe in the 40s, and nobody's comfortable. It's, you know, I feel like I'm in my basement, you know, and not the good side. I'm actually on the side with my laundry. And the fact that we're all sitting up so high, you know, this doesn't equate for actual dialogue, you know. If I'm so fortunate, I shouldn't say this out loud, but I would love to renovate this space. And I really think the space has a lot to do with the way the meetings are going. I mean, just the space alone. And there's a lot of information on how spaces make people feel, so I don't think I'm totally crazy by mentioning this. But beyond that, you know, the truth is right now our community is so traumatized. I actually, and I know this won't be popular, but I actually think we need to have more meetings right now. I actually think we should possibly be meeting every week. Two of those meetings could be just dialogue, and two could be actual citizen or business of the city council, because we still need to make sure the, you know, wheels are running and everyone's getting their paycheck and all that's happening. But, you know, this is an extraordinary time, and being more available to our community is what we really need. And I will say, I've been on the school board 6 years, the times I talk to most people are at the grocery store or when I'm at, like, the pool or I'm at soccer or the football games on a Friday night. Come on out. Everyone's going to want to tell you something. Harold and I were just watching it last Friday. So, you know, I think city council should be more available and we need better participation.
Thank you, Ms. Loeffler. We'll finish the question with you, Mr. Long.
As a child growing up in Philadelphia, I was raised in an Irish-American neighborhood, and I mention that because I enjoy watching C-SPAN, and I enjoy it when the Prime Minister of Great Britain appears before the House of Commons and is asked a variety of questions, and he or she has to be very sharp and have the answers right then and there. I think the reason we've had disruptions at City Council meeting is because we have a mayor who's anal retentive, is a control freak, and, you know, it doesn't know how to interact. We never had that problem with Dave Norris as mayor, and I disagreed. I ran against Dave Norris. I disagree with Dave Norris, but it was always civil. And when that happens, people's emotions erupt to what we've been seeing in the last City Council meetings. I believe, I go along with Mr. Loeffler, I think City Council should meet once a week. I think maybe once or twice a month we should be having City Council meetings in various neighborhoods. And they always talk about the rules. I think that three-minute rule is ridiculous and should be changed. I think people should have at least 7 to 8 minutes to address the council. And if that means the meeting goes at 2 or 3 o'clock, so be it. They're getting, you know, that's part of the democratic process. And the City Council people are getting paid to listen to the public. You cannot express your viewpoints in 2 or 3 minutes. And I have difficulty. I asked Joe, who invited me, I said, are you going to have that two-minute limitation? He said, yes. I feel frustrated when you have a two-minute limitation at a candidate forum, because what we're forced to do is give a soundbite. You know, difficult issues need more than 2 minutes to express opinions on, and the citizens need more than 3 minutes to express their viewpoints on a variety of topics. I resent the rule that was enforced, came into being when Mayor Singer took office, the City Council agreed to it, that City Council members were not allowed to respond to what the citizens were saying. That was delegated to the managing director, who waited for 1 or 2 weeks to give a response. City Council should be able to respond to what the citizens are saying at the beginning of the meeting. That should be brought back. I think that's the reason I'm saying all 5 members of City Council should resign or be forced out of office. We need a completely new City Council to take over.
Thank you, Mr. Long. Our next question, we will begin with you, Mr. Hall. How do you plan to get the city, the county, and the University of Virginia to work together to deal with some of our regional issues that we face in our community?
How do I want or need, or how would I get the city, county, and UVA to work together on our regional needs, was the question. Well, I think there are boards that are already appointed and put in place by the City Council to promote that very thing. I can't think of the acronyms right now, just which ones they are, but I know there are different boards that are put together to promote unity from the city and the county and UVA. There are problems that need to be solved. One is the Metropolitan Council. It's a Metropolitan Council. Now, I've got it in my notes somewhere. There are certain commissions that are put together to address needs from the City Council and UVA. These are the main governmental bodies in the city and in the county that work together, and the commissions promote harmony in taking care of problems. That's all I have to say about it.
Thank you, Mr. Hall. Ms. Hill.
If we can't look at ourselves as one community, then I think we're all doing ourselves a disservice. I would have my walk sheets, and all of a sudden, like, they would stop, and I'd be like, why? and it was like on the same street. I remember it was on Cottonwood when it really hit me. I was like, why does the person on this side of the dotted line care about our concerns any differently than the person within that line? We all are sharing a lot of the same resources and community and relationships. And it, to me, it really does come about relationship building, and that starts with the leaders and also has to trickle down to the communities and how we share our financial resources and how we, obviously we have this revenue sharing agreement that seems to be driving up in a discussion every year. I would be interested in looking at ways that we can allocate a percentage of that to really go towards things that are shared between the city and the county specifically. In the spring, met with multiple supervisors. I think that we really all have to be able to put our egos at the door. It can no longer be just about having power and like arm wrestling over, you know, who has what. This is one region, and when we need to really be operating, I would really stretch to say, how can we look at changing the way that we're structured so that it is more conducive for looking at ourselves as a region and not just an individual city surrounded by a county. And I really feel like in terms of UVA, I mean, they have a significant endowment, and I feel like they have a lot of opportunities where they could be really giving back to this community in the form of increasing the wages in which they pay their employees. They're a huge employer. The transportation that they provide to their employees and the way that that affects our community. I've said that I think that it's important that as we're looking at a new leader of the University of Virginia, why shouldn't we as a city council or as a city government have some kind of role in that selection process and have our voices be heard? And I would think that the county would want the same. I mean, this is going to be an important role, and that person could be there for a decade or 20 years, and I think that they need to come into that understanding the priorities of our community. And I'm sorry, I had more, but...
No, that's all right. Thank you, Ms. Hill. Mr. Jackson.
Well, for me, Charlottesville, UVA, and the county have always been kind of homogenous. And that's just me coming up because my family's from the county. Charlottesville has always been the county seat of Albemarle. And most people don't even realize we were actually the county seat of all the way up to Amherst before they split with us in Nelson. But before we get anything together, we need to pull stuff out in the open. We need to sit down with City Council, UVA, and Albemarle in front of our citizens and let you guys know what's going on. There was a moratorium on how far UVA could come down into our neighborhoods. That's no longer because Council changed the ordinances. So now Projects is in danger. 10th and Page. That's because we haven't sat down and said, okay, UVA, County, what's your plans? Tell the citizens. When you hear it from all three of us, nobody can backpedal. Because right now, UVA cannot eat Charlottesville. It's trying. And I think, you know, I'm not too sure about the new president. I've seen too many of them come and go. One mistake she made was when she said she didn't, UVA didn't have a financial bind with Charlottesville. Yes, you do. You're the largest employer here. We're actually your biggest providers of business when we come to see you. You have a connection with Charlottesville. Therefore, you have a connection with every neighborhood here, and you need to respect that. But we also have to give back that respect to the county and UVA. And we have to also realize this $18 million, the county is losing state and federal funds because they don't recognize our profit share or revenue share. Interesting, especially when the county just had to close the school. So we've got to work together, and it's going to have to be give and take.
Thank you, Mr. Jackson. Ms. Laufer.
Yeah, I would echo that this is a region. It's not these little fiefdoms, which it feels like. A couple things with UVA. I mean, even on the school board, they changed their policy on how they fund their health care. Any spouse at UVA that could get health care somewhere else needed to. They made that policy, and then it affected the schools by $125,000. Suddenly we have more people to insure. And I actually sat down with Teresa Sullivan. I just happened to see her, actually at Kroger, by the way. We didn't sit, but we were putting our groceries away. And I said, you know, this really affected us. You know, you have just started the ball rolling for every other private institution and public institution to have to do this. because, you know, and so I think we definitely, I really do agree that we should have a seat at the table in deciding on the next president. I'm not hopeful, but I do think that that is a reasonable expectation. And, you know, they've basically abdicated their responsibility for housing to their students, you know, so that's why we just see this constant creep. You know, what do we have? 40% of our homes are actually owner-occupied, 60% are rentals, and a lot of that is due to the UVA. And I think it's really important for us to have a working relationship with them and actually have dialogue. She had no idea that happened to the schools. You know, it's like, so if we actually had been at the table to talk about it, we could have done some problem-solving right there. And also with the county, you know, the bike lawsuit that we just went over, the reservoir, you know, this is a major problem, right? Because now we're trying to decide whose ordinance supersedes whose, right? We wanted to put a bike path in the reservoir, which they own that land, but we have jurisdiction to have things there. But it violated their zoning, and now we're under a lawsuit with them, and that really affects our working relationship with them. And think of all the other partnerships we have like that, like Burley Middle School. By the way, that's in the city, but it's by the county. The courts. I mean, we really have to be serious about working together. And I feel I do know some of the supervisors, and I feel confident that we could have a better relationship with them. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Laufer. To you, Mr. Long.
I think there's a variety of issues that should be shared with the county and UVA. And I'm going to repeat this. I've been in Charlotte over 20 years. Unlike Mr. Jackson, I haven't lived here for 50 years, and Ms. Walker, I will never ask a lady her age, but I'm sure, you know, having grown up here. But in the 20 years that I've been here, I've noticed how bad traffic has gotten in the last 20 years. And we don't need a $200,000 study to tell us that we need to improve our public transportation system. The only way we can do that is by having a regional transportation authority with the county, UVA, the city, and I would even say some of the surrounding counties as well, to solve that problem. I think the whole idea of the drug enforcement in this area should be regional. I don't think that a nonviolent drug offender needs to be in the regional jail. You know, it's a public health issue. We have 60% of the residents of the jail are there because of drug use, and they didn't commit any kind of violent crime. They should be out, and they should be in public health treatment. You know, and I've had 8 years working as a certified drug counselor in Philadelphia. From what I read, Ms. Walker has a lot of good experience in that area as well. These people need to be out of jail and in treatment centers. I think we need to work on a regional basis with UVA. The whole idea of if you're a felon and a kind of a drug conviction, you cannot get a job in this area. That should be changed. That should be made illegal. We're telling drug offenders to start living a clean, productive life, and they hit the streets and they can't get a job. How are they going to survive? It's an invitation for them to continue to commit crime. That's a regional issue as well. I worked at UVA Medical Center for 17 years. You know, I made a very good salary there, but I think a lot, and I came down because my sister was doing her residency as a doctor, and I think a lot of the UVA mentality, that they're pompous a lot of the times. And if, I don't know how many people watch The Big Bang Theory. It's a favorite show, the only TV show I watch. A lot of those professional professors act just like that. And God bless them, but they're very difficult to deal with. So I don't know how we're going to go about doing that. And I think maybe Dr. Sullivan falls in that category as well.
Thank you, Mr. Long. I'll make an official statement. It is a matter of public record to help out with what you referenced, Ms. Walker. All three of our ladies who are running for city council are 29 years of age.
Thank you. Only.
That's right. And holding. All right. Ms. Walker, finally to you. As we circle back, we're talking about collaboration between the city, the county, and the University of Virginia.
So, Paul, I'm 37. I don't mind at all. So I think first understanding that we are interdependent and that connection, it's no way to really, give
answers unless you are in the rooms and understand personality. But we know that we're not going to solve a lot of the challenges, jobs, housing, especially when you look at the land that is not in the city, and that we will, to resolve that issue, we will most likely have to use land that's county land to figure out this deficit that we have. We are going to have to work together. And about 2 years ago, city council, sometimes they make decisions after they think people are in bed asleep, but there was a report in the paper the next morning about a collaborative effort that later I was told they had spent over a year planning to bring the GEO group, which is one of the largest private prison organizations, into town to run a diversionary center. And just from how I work, it is difficult when someone has been in the business of mass incarceration to that they will take care of people in a diversionary program. So the city passed the funding for that program, but I was able to write a letter, do some research, send information to the county. One board of supervisor got back with me, and this is in my spare time, so no one was paying me to do this, but I heard a lot of what I put into my research package and the statements that the county board of supervisors made when they were discussing with journalists about why they did not support and did not fund the diversionary center. So I'm very open, and I listen well, learn well, and am willing to work, and we will not solve our issues without working together.
Thank you, Ms. Walker. We now turn, our next question is going to begin with you, Ms. Hill. If you had 2 minutes to convince the state legislature about decisions that they will make that will impact Charlottesville, what would you say?
Decisions the state legislature will make about decisions that will impact Charlottesville. Obviously, we live in a Dillon Rule state. I think that the more control that we can give to the city, which is localities, than we can to the states, just makes us all the more effective at really addressing our local needs. Obviously, I say here time and time again where we find ourselves strapped by the fact that we are a Dillon Rule state and the things that we want to enact locally. Obviously, this summer, so some of those things have come up. We are now, obviously relying on what the state has to do and make them having a decision. And obviously with the way that they're structured and the number of people on each side of the aisle, that makes it really difficult to get through some of the more progressive ideas that I think that we all share here locally. In terms of priorities, I think that those topics that really come to our personal safety in our community spaces is one that obviously is sensitive to all of us right now, so that we can have the authority to determine when open carry can be in what locations and to protect ourselves as a locality. I'm just trying to think of all the many massive things that we could address there.
It's a difficult question. It is. Again, what we're talking about is if you have a short amount of time to try and convince the state legislature about the decisions that they will make that will impact us here in Charlottesville, what would you say to them?
And for me, it really is. It's more overreaching that we just need to be able to be in a position where we can be driving the decisions of our community. And I just think that right now we just have very little flexibility and where our hands are tied. And it's frustrating, and I know that it's frustrating to the community because we hear it come up again and again. And I can see in our elected officials their frustration because they want to be responsive. But there's so many things that are driven out of the state that we just don't have control over.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Hill. Mr. Jackson.
Well, I'm going to try and stick with two because there are a couple of them. There's more than two, really. But first, I'd like for all the localities and school boards to get together and all the governing localities to get together and approach the state about the SOLs. Mm. I think it's a shame, and it came up one time with the school board about setting aside $1 million for remedial reading after you get your diploma. Like, they're really going to come back. We need to start focusing on, by fifth grade, our children should know how to read, comprehend and stuff. And then they can move on to the bigger and better classes because they'll have all that under their belt. We have to take time to make sure that our children are not falling through the cracks. And the SOLs do not allow that. You can easily be taught how to take a test. But once you get out of that school and you got to go and hit that register or something, it's a shame when you find people that can't count money even on cash register. And it's not funny. Because unfortunately, most of these are our children. They're the blacks and the poor whites. They're the poor people that are falling through the cracks. So I would ask them about the SOL. Secondly, how's about bringing some real jobs? I don't care if I got to work with Democrats or Republicans. My job is to make Charlottesville better, regardless of who we have to work with. Their job is to listen to us because you're their citizens too. So those are some of the things I want is jobs, real jobs. I mean, down in Mecklenburg, they got a $2.2 billion Microsoft plant. Why didn't we get it? We got all the infrastructure needed. So our job as council not to just run around on vacations and, oh, we went to this fact-finding trip and stuff. It's to bring back a job. I don't need to go to Italy if I can't bring back jobs for us.
Thank you, Mr. Jackson. Ms. Laufer.
Well, by the way, you only get a couple minutes with these people because that's just how it goes. You know, luckily, the school board and city council, we do have time to actually meet with our elected representatives. But, you know, the way to really do this is to find other communities that are facing the same challenges as you are and talk to them and get them to lobby their people, too. You know, we've done this on the school board, especially with the revenue sharing agreement. You know, every year, I bet people don't even know, every year there's a bill that goes in from Rob Bell. By the way, the county isn't asking for it. Rob Bell proposes a budgetary change to remove $2.5 million from the city school's budget and put it back into the county budget. And so what we did is we found out who are the other localities that have a revenue sharing agreement. You know what? They don't want this to change either. So every year we've fought it back successfully, and I anticipate we'll probably have the same thing this year. But I would actually really like true capital funds for improvements to schools and our technical colleges. You know, if you go, this room is an example of what we're facing at most of our schools right now. It's really outrageous to see the outdated classrooms and auditoriums that we have. It's really frustrating as a school board to try to see how you're going to come up with that money. And I applaud the city council now that has put in $1 million for actual improvements. You know, every year we have a fund, but it's only for maintenance to do the roof or do the windows or the facade, which always takes up, like, you know, millions of dollars, and then you don't actually have money to, you know, do something great. So I would absolutely lobby for technical education improvements and capital improvements on schools, and I would also go for the gun safety. I mean, it's completely outrageous what we saw on August 12th. I'm sorry to yell like this, but it was outrageous. I felt like our town was under siege from those militias, and that should never happen to anybody. Sorry.
Thank you, Ms. Laufer. Mr. Long.
Right after World War II in Pennsylvania... I'm 68, I can talk about World War II. The city of Philadelphia and the city of Pittsburgh approached the Pennsylvania legislature, and they were both given home rule charters. You know, and I don't know whether Pennsylvania at the time was as restrictive as the state of Virginia, but I think the city of Charlottesville should have a home rule charter where we have the leeway to make these decisions and not be restricted by state law. And I think that the state legislature should provide funding for the Regional Transit Authority. They gave Albemarle County and the city approval to do that, but it gave no funding mechanism for us to raise the funds to do that. I believe that when the state of Virginia mandates certain programs, they should also provide the money to fund it. And if they're not willing to fund it, then we shouldn't be legally obliged to to carry out these programs. And that's about it.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Long. Ms. Walker.
So I think we saw with the national election last November how important it is for us to change who we elect in office, and for that to matter, we have to be engaged and making sure that individuals who are more aligned with our thought process are in office. So again, when we look at Richmond, who is in Richmond, who are we lobbying to, who are we expecting to hear us? And from what I've seen, you know, I had a conversation a few years back with Deeds about the Department of Social Services when we were working on a case here. He did not hear us. He did not honor the mother that was sitting before him, pleading to him to assist her. So I think, everything we heard from the other five members, they are important, but none of that will matter unless we get officials in Richmond who are aligned with our value system, and we have to be clear first about what those are. So that's where I think we need to start. And then things like the Dillon Rule and not having control over your locality, those kind of issues, they won't come up, because people would understand the value of being able to make decisions for the area that you're living in.
Thank you, Ms. Walker. Finally, to you, Mr. Hall.
I have reached out to David Toscano on putting extended stop signs on CTS and other buses in Virginia. A pilot program has now been put in effect for school buses, so cars don't illegally passed around them when they're stopped. When reaching out to the state legislature, you must think in terms of regional or state needs. I think it is best to work with other elected representatives in the state and federal government in the same way. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hall. Our final question tonight is four questions in our first hour, four in our second. We'll begin with you, Mr. Jackson. And the question reads as follows. How will you take action, if elected to the city council, to make Charlottesville a more environmentally friendly city?
Environmentally friendly.
That's kind of weird. I mean, I just think it's kind of weird because, I mean, we were friendly, but we've actually cut down most of the bamboo, which, you know, gives off three times the oxygen that a regular tree does. So, you know, I've got to look at my predecessors and think of how environmentally friendly they were. And they love green space. So that's a good one. I mean, it really is, because I can't force you to get an eco car. I can only do what we can do for the city. And that's its people, and that's to keep the cost as low as possible using electric. I would really like to use the Go Green money so we can update a lot of the schools and stuff and tap into that, where we can actually lower the costs, lower our electric bills and our gas bills and everything else. We can also look at Go Green vehicles, which is now natural gas and things like that. I like propane myself, but that's just me. We're a natural gas city. But most of all, we can't keep destroying the green space. I mean, look at where it used to be trees. And I understand we need development in houses. But some of those places, they've cleared the green space, and you don't have anything. Grass, maybe some mud. What was the sense in clearing it? And you just eaten up half our oxygen. I mean, it's not the most breathable air that we used to have about 20 years ago. But we have to work together and work with the environmentalists to find out. And I do believe in climate change, and global warming is a reality.
Yeah.
And if this weather is not telling us that, I don't know if the sun has to fall on us to realize that. But it is reality.
Thank you, Mr. Jackson. Ms. Loeffler.
This is something I'm really passionate about. I got my undergrad degree in hydrogeology. I did water chemistry, and our kids are going to be cleaning up the mess that we are creating. You know, we have to get real about this. The federal government has basically hands off. They don't care. And I absolutely agree. You know, yeah, climate change is really happening, by the way. Like, aren't we getting another hurricane soon? You know, like, we have to be mindful. And, you know, I think the problem when we think about the environment is that people think it's too big. Like, what can they do? But it's really all these small acts that we do on a daily basis and being more conscious of it is what is going to make things change. And I've proposed that we could ban plastic bags, actually, at any of our city events. You know, we can't actually ban it in the whole city because I went and researched that, and because of Dylan's rule, we can't do that. But we could work with incentivizing our businesses to offer cloth bags. You know, I think that's something that could be really interesting. I also applaud the idea of all the solar power that our city has been initiating with not just their public buildings, but with residential. I think we could increase that. And all of our new infrastructure and our new buildings. The truth is we know more now than we ever have on how to build more environmentally sustainably. And we really should be doing those things. We should be incentivizing the people that are going to build the homes to do those things. And I know we already have tax credits through the state. And well, I don't know if the federal government is going to continue, but I really think we need to be really aware of that and promote it within not just as a government, but within each other. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Laufer. Mr. Long.
I agree with Mr. Jackson that we should be creating more green space. I also agree with Ms. Offer about, you know, using solar power. But I think if I am elected to city council, I'm going to be voting against every new hotel development. I think it's a shame, with the exception of Ms. Sakos, who voted against it, that they gave $1 million tax break for John Dewberry for his Landmark Hotel. That should have been torn down. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and so I would vote against every single, for the 4 years, if I'm elected, any new hotel development in the city, let them build them out of our county. You know, but that's one thing I think can be done. I'd make it extremely difficult for them to be able to move into the city. But I would also suggest, and I'm going to talk about the transit authority again, the way to cut down on pollution is to get more people to stop using their cars and using public transportation at least some of the times when they go into their jobs, or whether they're coming downtown to go to the Paramount or whatever, get more people out of the vehicles and into public buses and reduce the traffic congestion that we have in the city. That's it.
Thank you, Mr. Long. Ms. Walker.
Mm-hmm. And so just a quick, instead of tearing down something like the Landmark, the city could invest in it, finish it, and provide housing for homeless, low-income, and workforce. So that's an idea there. But when you talk about, I'll talk about the environment from an environmental justice perspective. We talk about green space. We talk about clean water, clean air. I know I turn on my faucet sometime. I can smell chlorine coming out of it. I have called and asked why. Could I smell it? I was told algae growth, but that's clearly something, you know, that we need to fix. Clean water, access to solar. When you talk about wind power, that's definitely going to have to be a city-county collaboration because we're going to need the land. But, again, when we think about these things and being eco-friendly in our environmental landscape, who has access to even the comforts of thinking about air quality, water, solar panels? And so we need to create a city where, to thrive, we know we have to move into that direction, but that all people, you know, have access to. So by us working on the issue, the disparities within our community, we will end up with a community that is healthier and more environmentally friendly. And so we need to make sure that we understand that. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Walker. Mr. Hall.
question is, how will I take action if elected to the city council to make Charlottesville a more environmentally friendly city? Well, I would champion the use of fun city functions in our parks and recreation areas that do not impinge on the environment, so that all citizens can enjoy holidays in the parks and do things that are free for our citizens and their enjoyment. Coordinate with Brian Daly, the head of Parks and Recreation in Charlottesville, to get this done. For example, McIntyre Park has golf and botanical garden. There's basketball, tennis, and swimming. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Hall. And finally to you, Ms. Hill, for this question.
Obviously, the quality of where you live affects your health outcomes, and literal health of all in our community must be all of our top priority. Broadly speaking, it relates to our multimodal transportation, the approach that we take and how we determine to grow this city, including our housing stock, both existing and the planned, and the ease of accessibility that we have to those green spaces that so many other people have mentioned. For multimodal systems, the quality of these systems really ties to their use. We are a really car-dependent community, and we really need to have advanced the access and efficiency of our public transit system, as Mr. Long enjoys talking about, as well as our bike and pedestrian infrastructure. And that a lot of it goes with our regional plans and how we work with our county to do so. Mindful growth, the form and function of our growth, which improves our quality of life versus detracting from it. Around better development, not no development, which is based on what our community envisions, enabling and encouraging housing density in a way that integrates with our neighborhoods and doesn't distract from them. Pursuing policies incentivizing the needs of amenities such as fresh foods and proximity with our housing. And again, like, we need to be designing for the maximum walkability, including our smaller block configurations. And, but we're specific to housing talk. It's really largely inefficient mid-century construction, battling market drivers, often resulting in a product that's not sustainable. We need to evaluate opportunity areas for clean energy in our affordable housing. We obviously have all talked about the need to increase those numbers throughout our community. But if we think about it, the higher percentage of income for those families, if we can provide them with the infrastructure of those efficiencies up front, is going to result in little to no utility costs in the long run for those families. And last but not least, green spaces, as people have mentioned, accessibility to our parks and open spaces, they truly contribute to our quality of life. And I think that everyone in this community deserves to have easy access to those, for whether you're 2 or 92. And so I think that we look at distribution throughout our streets and the usable open green spaces. We really have to have more outdoor time. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Hill. That concludes our questions for tonight. It is now time for our candidates to make their closing statements. We will begin in reverse order of how we began the evening, so that means that our first closing statement will come from Ms. Walker.
So, Virginia Organizing, again, thanks for inviting me and hosting the forum. I have worked in direct service, serving people, since 2004. I've been an advocate. When I was in elementary school, I was advocating. When I was in the high school, you know, I still run into Mr. Leatherwood, who said, "Whew." You know, the kind of conversations we used to have when I thought that individuals weren't being treated fairly, when they weren't in an environment where they could learn, this whole dualistic two-tier school system that we have had when I was in school and still have, I've been advocating against. So as a city council member, I will make sure that, one, the transparency piece is key to me. I'm a very transparent, open person. I think that's a lot of what we're losing here. But I will be fair. I am an advocate for justice. I'm an advocate for truth. And I will continue that work on council. We have to heal as a city, and we have to do the work to heal as a city. If you study racism, you understand that racism requires power, that it's overt or covert, it's intentional or unintentional. And when you talk about the people who have had power in this country and in the city to dismantle it, we have to be willing to look at it. And so that will take a collaborative effort, but we also have to make sure that we are willing and up for the challenges. And I am going to continue to do the work that I've been doing, whether I'm on city council or not, but I know that I would do a great job as a city council member. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Wilson. Mr. Long.
The city of Charlottesville is in a mess. It's a one-party city, you know, and I don't think that one-party domination serves anybody. And Ms. Laufer and Ms. Hill are both very decent people and have presented some very good issues, and I'm sure there'd be conscientious councilors if they're elected. But I think it's time to put an end to one-party rule in the city. There's four independent candidates, and I think we need to send a message to the Democratic Party that their nonsense has got to stop. You know, there's a reason why the Republican Party doesn't run candidates in Charlottesville, because the current three-member majority, Mr. Bellamy, Mayor Signer, and Kathy Gavin, Signer is a corporate attorney. And back 2 years ago when they ran, they raised $77,000. Most of their funding came from Mark Brown and realtors, and that's who they're serving. I've told Mayor Signer that he's a lackey for big business. I believe the entire city council are lackeys for big business. That has got to stop. I have always believed in the Democratic Party, but the Democratic Party in Charlottesville is not the party of Franklin Roosevelt or Lyndon Johnson or Harry Truman. And the best way to do that is four independent candidates, choose the two that you would think is best, and send a message to the power structure in the Democratic Party that times have got to change. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Long.
So I, too, just want to say thank you to Virginia Organizing for hosting this event, and thank you to all of you who have been here for almost 2 hours. You know, that's a serious commitment. It's really been a pleasure, and I've enjoyed discussing all these important issues. I am a Democrat, and I'm really proud of it. You know, I have been on the school board lobbying in the state government, and I can tell you there's not a lot of us, okay? And the reason we keep getting the kind of policies is because they keep electing the same people. You know, I actually started a women's group called Virginia's List. We are a subsidiary of Emily's List. We support Democratic women running for state office. When I started this organization, we only had 17% women in the state of the General Assembly. Now we're up to 19. I mean, my goodness. We are 51% of the population. And when I go to Richmond, it really burns my blood to see that. You know, so absolutely, we need to change who's being elected all across the state. And I would just put a plug in for Ralph Northam. He's on the top of the ticket as the governor. You know, we need to maintain that seat. We have Justin Fairfax as lieutenant governor and Mark Herring for attorney general. But besides that, it's really been a pleasure to actually listen to all the candidates. Thank you, Ms. Walker and Mr. Long, Mr. Hall, and Mr. Jackson. I've never had a chance to really talk with you guys, so this is a real pleasure. And it's been a really great experience meeting Ms. Hill and working with her since the primary. You know, I didn't talk about a lot of things I want to do, which is affordable housing. We did touch on that Piedmont Promise, supporting our kids going to PVCC. I want to work on transportation. I think we need to be more efficient in all modes. And the environment, of course, we talked about, and responsive and transparent and responsible government. And I look forward to talking with you more afterwards as the months go on. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Laufer. Mr. Jackson.
I could go through all the things I've done, but I'm not going there, because when you do things out of the goodness of your heart for the right reason, it doesn't make a difference. I'm well aware of what Charlottesville has been through for 50 years, what it's been through. Just recently, what we've been through. Whoever says you choose for your city councilors, they're going to have to deal with this, because Lord knows the other five didn't. So you're going to have to pick two strong councilors who's going to have to get up there and face this down. And say, yes, we have problems. Yes, we're falling behind. Yes, there are things we need to do.
I'm willing to roll up my sleeves and take that risk. I'm not going to sit here and sugarcoat things. I've never been one to do that. That's just not me. I'm not going to hide things. I believe in openness. I believe in transparency for the simple fact if you lie, you're going to have to keep on lying. If you try and cover the truth, you're going to have to keep on trying to cover the truth. And right now, half of us really don't know what's going on. Don't care how many meetings you sit in. It's the meetings they've had in that room. And you're sitting there like, oh, yeah, okay. But you don't know what they've talked about in there for 2 hours. I don't like that. I don't like having meetings before the meetings. Give me my table back in a timely fashion. Let me read it. If I don't understand it, we ain't voting on it. Too many often we sit down and, oh, well, this sounds good, and this is what our people want and stuff. And that's what happens when you get that one-party system. I'm not a millionaire. And no, that's one reason we never really talk, because I don't go out and hang out at Hamilton's and stuff. I'm just a regular, simple person. I know millionaires. I can sit down at their houses and stuff. But I like being me. And I like our city to be for everyone.
Thank you, Mr. Jackson. Ms. Hill.
Thank you again. I'll echo the thanks to Virginia Organizing for providing us this opportunity. Thank you to all the fellow candidates for sharing all of your perspectives. And most importantly, thank you. It's really great to have citizen engagement in this process. So I really appreciate the crowd that's here this evening. I personally have learned a lot tonight. For one, I'll think a little bit more about what I want to do with the General Assembly if I have that 2 minutes. But I'm really committed to continuing to learn. I think every day is a learning journey, and the recent events have certainly impacted our community in transformational ways. In order to understand the shifts in those positions that I heard and made a map about from the spring, it's going to require me to really recommit to that listening journey and continue to do so. And I don't only want to commit to doing it in the fall, but I want to commit to doing it for the 4 years that I have, you know, if elected, have the opportunity to be in this position. I think that we all have to have our finger on the pulse of this community through changing environment, all the time. This environment is changing around us. I hope to find and share solace and hope and inspiration through all those conversations, because that's what I felt to date when I through those conversations that I've had, and I'm excited to continue to get back out there. I've been known to meet with everyone. I literally met with one of my first Twitter trolls. I've met with people who I know will not vote for me. I've also met with ardent supporters and my next-door neighbors. And I'm really happy to talk with any of you. On my information cards is literally a direct number to my phone and an email that comes directly to me. And I really welcome the opportunity to have that direct connection with individuals. Ultimately, however, we must move from talk into action in order to address this community's concerns. I am running as a Democrat, and Democrats are considered the progressive party, and progress means change. Unless we distill our voices into priorities and take action on those priorities, we're not going to get the changes that we want. I'm committed to partnering with many in our community on priority issues, including every person up here, regardless of the outcome. I do believe that City Council's success is dependent on being the conduit for your ideas and perspectives throughout our community. Again, your ideas and your strengths. And I invite you to join me. Thank you.
Thank you very much. To you, Mr. Hall.
Charlottesville has now gone through some tumultuous times. We must all try and mend our broken hearts as we make suggestions to one another for future successful living. Here are some 14 suggestions. 1, work at something you enjoy, worthy of your time and talent. 2, give people more than they expect and do it cheerfully. 3, be forgiving of yourself and others. 4, be generous. 5, have a grateful heart. 6, discipline yourself to save money and even the most modest salary. 7, commit yourself to constant improvement. 8, commit yourself to quality. 9, be loyal. 10, be honest. 11, be decisive, even though you'll sometimes be wrong. 12, help move our city forward. 13, be bold and courageous. 14, take good care of those you love. So be reassured that I will do my best to serve you as your city councilman. Thank you.
Again, I want to remind you that the deadline for registering or re-registering to vote is October the 16th. Again, we want to thank you as an audience for your participation tonight. Can we have one more round of applause for our candidates this evening?
And thank you, Jay James.
Best wishes to our candidates. Everybody have a good night. Thank you.